The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we don't
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books Podcast. Former NEA Chairman Bill Ivey returns this week, and we discuss the unexpected election of Trump. Ivey made the news recently when his March 13, 2016 email to Clinton campaign chairman John Podesta was published by WikiLeaks, and he's returning in order to give us an insider's perspective on the election. Here's a short excerpt from that infamous email. "We've all been quite content to demean government, drop civics, and in general conspire to produce an unaware and compliant citizenry. The unawareness remains strong, but compliance is obviously fading rapidly. It's Wednesday, November 30th, 2016, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. I want to thank Zero Books Club members and encourage you to join. Zero Books Club members gain access to a second podcast each week. The Inside Zero Books podcast sometimes features a second hour from this podcast, and sometimes features conversations about the left and left publishing with members of the Zero Books editorial team. And the next Inside Zero Books podcast will feature something of a shouting match between myself and a couple of Portland State University philosophy students as we discuss Judith Butler, Edward Said, and the whiteness of philosophy and scientific reason. In this episode, you'll hear a clip from the At Midnight debate between Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders, or their impersonators, as well as Hail to the Chief. Bill Ivey is an American folklorist and was the seventh chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts. He is also the author of Engaging Art, The Next Great Transformation of America's Cultural Life, and Arts Incorporated, How Greed and Neglect Have Destroyed Our Cultural Rights. But Bill Ivey is also a friend of John Podesta's. He was recently in the news when one of his emails to Podesta was published by WikiLeaks. And in this email, he described Washington elites as having dropped civics and direct engagement with voters and instead preferring to demean government and rely on voters being uninformed and compliant. And I think the pull quote from that email, and this is a paraphrase, is that the voters unfortunately remain uninformed, but they're no longer compliant. This is a dangerous time, something along those lines. Anyhow, I'm very glad to have you back on the podcast, Bill. And I want to talk to you about just how dangerous a time this really is.
Yeah, it's an interesting time. I mean, of course, I was very disappointed in the outcome of the election, and I'm somewhat dismayed by some of the likely occurrences that will follow, particularly around domestic policy and the dismantling of some innovative parts of the social safety net, and maybe even attacks on some things that we've taken for granted, like Medicare and so on, and who knows what will happen internationally. So I think that it is a challenging time. I think obviously it's intriguing to observe and see what will happen, given the fact that we've got a president-elect who has a very kind of unusual temperament for the role and seems to be on edge and quick to respond to any kind of insult or attack, and a team that really has not been seasoned through working with him over the years, but really has had to be assembled kind of at the last minute, and so it's going to be, I think, a very much a work in progress for for quite a while. So I think the opportunity, or I guess maybe that's not the right word, the chance that there'll be some real problems along the way, particularly in the next 6 months or year. I think it's a very real possibility. So I think it is a dangerous time for the country, and in a way, a dangerous time for our democracy.
My first question that I had written down was, I was going to ask you how surprised you were by the results of the election, but what you just said makes me want to change my question. How surprised do you think the Trump campaign was by the results of the presidential election?
Everything they've said is to the contrary, but my guess is that they were quite surprised, and I think they were reading the same polls that everybody else was and probably had very similar internal numbers. I also get the sense that they had a plan, but it was a plan for what I would call losing big. In other words, making a very good showing, but not so much thinking about governing, but thinking instead about moving out into a kind of an adversarial position where they would attack a Clinton administration and encourage investigations and hearings and just in general, continue to pump up the anger and frustration that hardcore Trump supporters felt, but not really get in the business of governing. I think there was and continues to be, as we look at the transition, I think a fair strong indications that there wasn't a lot of pre-election preparation for a transition into governing. And I can say that from some experience, because when President Obama was running for the first time, I became part of something called the Obama Transition Project, which started the summer before the election. And the purpose of it was to do the kind of look at federal agencies that you could do without actually going and talking to them. In other words, use public documents, but give the president-elect a one-page summary of the key issues and opportunities around each agency of government that would be there on a desk the day after the election. And that would be a kind of prelude to the real transition, which would happen after the election. And I think it was John Podesta who put that together, and then he became the co-director of the transition itself. And so we had been engaged in a lot of preparation for a transition even before the election, knowing that, if you lose, it doesn't mean anything, but if you win, it can be very helpful. And I don't get the sense that the Trump team had that.
Right. Well, that's troubling in itself. So have you spoken to John Podesta, your friend?
I haven't. I don't exactly know how to find him. The Brooklyn offices of the campaign are pretty much shut down. I assume he's back in Washington. I don't use the old email account, his personal one, because that's the one that was hacked. And so I'm kind of waiting for some kind of a sign as to where he is and what his next affiliation will be, whether it's going to be back with the Center for American Progress or back, he's been a law professor right along through everything that he's done. And so we'll just see where he lands and when his head comes up above water, and then I'll quickly try to get in touch with him. I feel very, very badly for him. I did not have a big personal stake in Secretary Clinton's winning and becoming president, but many of my friends and associates, really were preparing themselves and anticipating a role in a new government. And of course, for them, it's a tremendous disappointment. And for people who devoted a year or 18 months of their lives to this thing, it's a real heartbreak. So it takes some time to get over it, and I feel for them.
Yeah. So you've been talking to people around the Clinton campaign, people who were prepared and preparing for jobs in the administration.
Yes.
How able are they to get a good impression or make any kind of real judgment about what went wrong, or are they just still in a state of shock? I mean, do you think people are coming to terms with what happened and trying to figure out what explains Clinton's loss?
I think they're coming to terms with what happened. Whether we are all coming to terms with the underlying cause, I think is still an open question. I mean, clearly, we underestimated the extent to which there was a powerful sentiment for change. Although, frankly, when you look back on it, and I fault myself in this way too, what happened in the Republican primary should have been a pretty good indication, because they had some very credible candidates, and they just could not get a grip on what was coming at them from Trump and his supporters, and they couldn't seem to deflect or respond in an effective way. And you know, as we know now from experience, that carried all the way through to the general election. And you know, I think this is just me talking, but I've been saying this in different ways for years. But I think there's a pretty well established paradigm in D.C. Bipartisan, both Republicans and Democrats do it, kind of a paradigm about how you campaign and how you lead and how you position your message. And I think it has a very strong focus on kind of analyzing populations, figuring out demography or income, these kinds of things, and then sort of applying messaging that influences those groups of people. And that's what I was alluding to when in my email to John, and I've said as much in any number of Center for American Progress trustees meetings over the years. And I just think that you always start, when you think about a failed campaign, you start by saying, well, our candidate and her message didn't capture the imagination of the American people to a sufficient degree. I mean, that has to be your starting point. It's not about who didn't turn out or, what levers weren't pulled. I think it's really about, kind of a failure of candidate and message. And then you can go on to analyze it. And to me, I felt all along that Democrats in general and the Clinton campaign in particular really needed a really big, a robust visionary message that could stand proudly beside or even overwhelm this notion of making America great again. And I don't think that was considered to be all that important. I think it was really a paradigm that says, well, let's just do a lot of really good policies. And then if we do the policy right, we'll win, and the vision will kind of bubble up out of them. And I think it's been demonstrated that it doesn't really work that way. So I think that, to me, that's one of the primary problems. I know there's been a lot of written comment over the last couple of weeks about identity politics, which is close to what I'm being critical of. And I agree that but it's almost funny in a way. The failure was we relied on identity politics without any of these commentators expressing what we should have relied on. And I always think you start with a big vision, something that people can get behind, and then you put the policies under. The vision gives you the why, the policies gives you the what you're going to do. And I think we lacked a why in a year when there was much more sentiment just for change than anybody anticipated.
Thinking back to the primaries, it seemed to me at the time that there were two populist candidates. There was Trump and there was Bernie Sanders. And something similar was happening in both parties. Trump was able to, despite the party itself completely opposing him, do very, very well and then finally get the nomination. Sanders had a similar thing happen. He did much, much better than anyone anticipated or wanted him to do, on the side of the DNC. And they were both carried along by kind of mass popular movements. They both seemed to have strong, if opposing, visions. When I thought they might both get the nomination, I thought we're going to have a real ideological election season for the first time in my lifetime. There's like an actual Does not this dime's worth of difference stuff is out the window if you have Bernie Sanders against Trump.
Polar political opposites, but they both seem to have a ring of authenticity to their supporters that bucks the traditional political system. They're both very active on social media, one as a socialist, the other as a sociopath. And they're here to desperately pander for your votes on the first ever At Midnight presidential debate. A lot, thank you, yes, of course. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome our first candidate, Donald J. Trump.
Get him out of here. Get him out of here. Get him out of here.
Mr. Trump, we're not going to eject anyone from the audience just for booing you.
Waterboard them, then.
We're not going to waterboard anyone.
Kill their families. Kill their families.
That's your solution for everything, sir. That's your solution for everything. And also, your opponent tonight, Senator Bernie Sanders.
Thank you.
All right. Excellent. Gentlemen, welcome. Thank you very much for being here, giving us your time here on At Midnight. You had a lot of choices, and you came here, and we appreciate it. You're right, Senator Sanders.
I don't think this guy's going to make it to the election. I mean, are you kidding me? Unbelievable.
I think there is some contrast between the candidates you see on stage. This might not be the debate you get, but this is the debate you deserve.
All right, thank you very much, Senator Sanders. All right, gentlemen, very thought-provoking.
But then Sanders was not able to get the nomination. The Clinton machine was more effective than anything the Republicans had. And it seemed to me, especially in retrospect, it seems to me, that the difference is the Republican Party isn't as riven by demographics and identity differences. I mean, it's basically a white party, whereas there are lots of different factions within the Democratic Party, and they can be set against each other. So, for instance, you know, the black vote was and black organizers were sort of sicked on the Sanders campaign, which I think had a big effect. So I'm not sure if I have an actual question at the end of that, but maybe I'll just ask you, what do you think of that analysis?
Well, I agree with it to an extent. I do think that, I think that the Republican Party and the coalition that came together to support Trump was more complex than simply white people. And I think that what we're going to see as Republicans try to govern, since they control the entire government, as that process goes on, we're going to start to see what the divisions really were or really are in that coalition. Now, it's probably not quite as pronounced as they could be on the Democratic side, but in a way, it goes back to my point. I mean, I think that it's very critical, if you're relying on a coalition, to have something in your message that is really about what everybody cares about and wants to do together, rather than simply a bunch of little things that please one group and maybe not another so much. And I think that's one of the things that was missing. I agree with you completely that, you know, in a sense, my out of the gate when the whole campaign was just unformed, I mean, Elizabeth Warren was my initial choice. I just thought that that would be great. And then I kind of like Bernie, but I didn't know about whether he could jump up and put together an entire government, although obviously he could have done as well or better than Trump could have done. But I do think, and then of course I was also interested in Joe Biden, simply because of his experience, and he's a certain kind of campaigner, and I think he maybe is almost the only guy on our side, except maybe for a younger Bill Clinton, who could have really gone head to head with Trump. And, you know, maybe Sanders could have, but I think Biden could have. But anyway, I think that the Democratic establishment did kick in and say, no, this is going to be Hillary's year. And that came from a lot of different directions, from an effective campaign, but just a bunch of people up and down the line. And you know, and now here's where we are. It's going to be fascinating to, you know, to go back to an earlier question of yours. I think it's going to be interesting to see if my party can really have the kind of thoughtful discussion about what happened and then what we need to do. I think one of the things that's hardwired into this situation now is that they're going to be a lot of Trump supporters who are just going to be aghast when they wake up one morning and the Paul Ryan budget is going to get passed and it's going to try to privatize Medicare. And they're just going to be, you know, shocked when, you know, the other part of the country where I spend a lot of time is the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. Well, it went overwhelmingly for Trump, but it's a part of the U.S. that requires huge support from the social safety net from all directions. And again, when those things start to get dismantled or attacked, I think there's going to be some buyer's remorse. I for a variety of reasons, I spend time around people who voted for Trump. And one of the things that struck me was that there was really no excitement or enthusiasm after he won. There was a lot of unhappiness with the idea of Hillary being president in advance, even among some of my kind of rural Democratic friends who basically come out of a labor, kind of an old-fashioned union perspective. They were very uncomfortable with her. They weren't going to vote for Trump, but there were a lot of people who just said, man, I can't stand the idea of Hillary Clinton. We're going to vote for Trump. And then the morning after, nobody was saying, oh, I'm so excited! America's going to be great again. This guy's going to solve it. Everything's going to be good now. There was just a lot of concern, and so we'll see how quickly the cracks that right now are papered over on the Republican side, how quickly those divisions are going to show up, and then let's see if my side can find a way to get together so the coalition starts to think of itself as something that's united rather than just all these different factions.
If we agree that there was a populist moment in this election there were two sides to it, and it could have been Elizabeth Warren, it could have been Bernie Sanders. I don't think it could have been Joe Biden, but who captured that. But in any case, if we agree that this was happening across the country and it wasn't really divided by what we think of as normal politics. It wasn't a Republican phenomenon. It wasn't a Democratic phenomenon. Then we have to start thinking about, like, what's behind that, the unrest, essentially, in the public. And I tend to think it goes back to 2008, the crisis that Obama has been managing since then. And the crisis that's not only in the United States, but in Europe as well. The things that you've been talking about, like Medicare and you know, other parts of the social safety net, are very serious. But if this is actually a part of a wider trend towards not just conservative politics, but some sort of, I'll call it alt-right or far-right or proto-fascist kind of politics, don't we need to reset and reappraise how to respond to that?
Well, I think we do, and I don't disagree with your underlying assumption. In fact, I might take it further than you would take it, which is I think we're in a. And I'm writing a book about this now, but I really think we're in a significant time of transformation that will one day have a name like the Renaissance or the Industrial Revolution or, or Dark Ages. I mean, it'll have a name. We don't know what that name is yet, but I think it's a global phenomenon. And I think it's a pushback against a set of core values that have been around so long that they were assumed to be permanent. And that's a belief in, kind of a secular belief in science and a kind of a sense of social justice and a notion that of women's rights and of sort of a cooperative atmosphere among nations and among religions, entities that were once at at each other's throats, and the kind of thinking that fuels concepts like the United Nations and a photo exhibit like the Family of Man. I mean, those are very old assumptions. They're old values, and I think they're being challenged on a global basis, and it may be a pushback against colonial thinking on the part of elites that's been around for a couple hundred years. It may have some other kind of root cause, but for whatever reason, a lot of things that we thought were permanently in place, I think, are being challenged on a global basis, and it looks more extreme when it's the Taliban and less extreme when it's the Tea Party, but I think there's linkage. And I think people who care about quality of life and the way democracies and even the leading nations can work with one another and govern are going to have to figure out a way to address what I think is a profound change. As I said a couple of minutes ago, I think it'll be this will be a named time. We've looked at it in terms of the globalization. We've fallen in love with globalization, and we fall out of love with it. We think about technology. We love it. Now we are maybe a little more suspicious, but I don't think we've really found our way to the core of the transformation that's going on right now. I mean, 2 years ago, I went back and reread, Brave New World in 1984. And if you read those two volumes, the kinds of things that we're experiencing now in terms of encouraged passivity and control and oversight and all of these things, a lot of them are in those books. And we don't quite seem to be able to get out of the everyday and the mundane far enough to really think about how profound these changes really might be.
I mean, we really are living in those dystopian science fiction novels, in some of the details. We carry around phones that have cameras on them that the government can access any time. That's not very different than the telescreens in 1984.
Yeah, they can access our location at any time. And, we put up with big changes in quality of life in order to be with it, consumers. Steve Jobs still looks like, a big hero because of what he did. But maybe he's the devil. He convinced us that these things that really should have been treated as machines at arm's length were somehow our friends, and so we took them into our lives like beloved intelligent pets, and they're really not lovable intelligent pets. They're something more alien. We're not really getting to it yet. But to go back to the political, I do think that the ability of huge chunks of populations to fall back into tribalism, religious fundamentalism, a distrust of science, a distrust of authority, contempt for education, that constitutes a global, profound transformation, and it opens everything up to fascist dictators who have explanations and authority.
The reason I wanted to get you back on the podcast was partly because I'm really angry at the elites, and I feel like you're like near them. The problem with what you're saying is that the educated, the urban, the Democrats, all of you have actually sort of been exposed. So it's hard for, I mean, it's easy for me to understand why people are so upset at the educated, you know? It's easy for me to understand why if you're in Pennsylvania and you're in a coal mining town that's shutting down, that, yeah, you're not going to have anything to do with some pencil neck geek like me or you.
No, I totally get it. And in fact, in my description of what I think is going on, I'm not suggesting that people have just lost their minds. In other words, I think that that if there's one characteristic of the last couple of hundred years, it's been that education, and even education and learning that passes as wisdom, hasn't been deployed in a way that would really, really in a fundamental way, help the people who have been brought into the story. They're in the story, but they're not really being helped. And, you know, you probably have run into, you know, it's very hard to not look at something like Michel Foucault, you know, and his notion that all of these interventions, whether it's a social welfare system or Freudian psychoanalysis, that all of these things that come from civilization, the elites, and the educated, that try to explain or help the masses, are really not much more than mechanisms of oversight and control. And I think one of the possibilities is that we're living the kind of pushback against a couple of centuries of arrogant intervention that didn't really listen, that talked at people and didn't listen to them. And one of the things that I like about my academic discipline, about folklore, is that it's been relatively on the passive side of things, and it does tend to listen. And I think I think folklorists who are out in communities do have some sense that people are not just demographic ciphers. They actually are complex bundles of emotions and intelligence and insight, just like us, you know. But you've got to, if you're going to do anything effective with that, you've got to go out and listen to people.
My problem with Foucault is that he seems to believe in this unformed, direct experience of life that are unshaped, unmediated, a way to live that's sort of nostalgic in its strange way. Or he champions the underclass and the subaltern simply for being on the outside. Whereas from a Marxist perspective, the idea is to give people control over the mechanisms of control, to have the masses of people not only voting for who, you know, the representative is going to be, but engaged enough to be thinking about new ways to structure and organize their world.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're starting to talk like a little bit inside again.
I think
Marx has, you know, there's a big streak of nostalgia, and you know, you can take Marx and put him in there with you know, William Morris and John Ruskin and sort of other arts and crafts nostalgic thinkers, and Marx just took some of that. He took his understanding of the failings of industrial production and the social effects of industrial production much further than those other guys did. But there's a streak of romanticism and a streak of nostalgia there also for, you know, a different, a better way of life. But I think one of the you know, one of the things we're facing now, I think, is a breakdown of, you know, sort of conventional visions of modernity. I don't think that the Marxist view, particularly the view of how society should be structured, or the role of industrial production as the only driver of historical change and that kind of thing, I don't know that holds up. Nor do I think that's necessarily going to be invoked as a solution. But you know, I mean, certainly the Marxist critique of capitalism, I think, is maybe in some ways more relevant than ever. In the book of mine that you didn't mention, the one called Handmaking America, which is much more political, you know, I talk about Marx's, you know, I just say, well, he would be spinning in his grave with delight at the way things that he saw have been accelerated by, you know, he didn't even have to think about advertising. He didn't have to think about social media. And if you threw those things into his, you know, into his model, he'd have an awful lot to say about it, and many of those things would help his arguments. But that's, you know, that's to me, I think the critique is where I like to stop, and then try to figure out, well, you know, what do we do? You know, I don't know.
It comes down to cultural values, right? I mean, the problem that we have is that these cultural enlightenment values that we've had for a long time are no longer working. People feel left out. They actually are left out because of the economic crisis. And we need to develop some new values to organize around.
Yeah, well, we need new values, or we need to revisit the values that have been talked about for a couple hundred years, and look at the inadequacies of the way they were honored or implemented or put into play. To me, that's really where if you look back on the values that gave us the United Nations, I mean, so much of that justified rather harsh interventions on a global basis, you know, from Native Americans to tribes in West Africa to India and Pakistan. And, you know, these are things that if you're manipulative and somewhat cruel to people for a couple of hundred years, even with the best intentions and the best rhetoric, they'll turn on you. You know, they'll say, "Wait a minute, I'm not going to put up with that anymore." And I think we're kind of in that place right now. And one of the big challenges for people who do want to try to lead is to say, "Well, can we back up and say, yeah, we were wrong about this. You know, we need to think about this in a really different way."
Right.
And I don't see anything at this point that indicates that's going to happen. But, you know, we're at the beginning. You know, I said at the beginning of our conversation, I mean, I'm so intrigued by the situation with Trump because he's so different than anything we've had. His personality may, you know, he may be very successful as president. I really don't have any idea, but it's so different. I wonder to myself in a maybe not very convincing way, but I'm trying to talk myself into it. Maybe he does have the answer in some way, but the answer might be really authoritarian, my way or the highway. And we know from history that can be pretty attractive.
Back to just some political questions here. The power of the executive has expanded under Bush. It started to expand after 9/11. I mean, it was probably expanding before that under Clinton, I think it was. But certainly since 9/11, Bush expanded the power of the executive. That was really Cheney's doing. Those new powers were taken up by the Obama administration and seemingly sort of institutionalized and made permanent. And we're talking about, you know, domestic surveillance, the ability to use drone warfare, even on the domestic population, if I understand correctly, that the power is there. Those are the two that really come to mind. But, you know, the suspension of habeas corpus, all of this seems to have been now institutionalized. Is there any chance, given what's coming, that Obama might do something with his executive powers to undo some of that before Trump takes office? Because I didn't trust Obama with that power. I don't think anyone's trustworthy with that power, but I certainly don't trust someone like Donald Trump with that kind of authority.
Well, you're asking someone who, you know, in terms of things like that, I'm merely an observer.
Right.
One of the things I've observed, and I don't know whether I'm pleasantly surprised or a bit unsettled by this, but President Obama has given every indication that he wants to be a helpful partner to Trump as he moves into this role as president.
Yeah.
And while I can imagine him doing some things around the margins, I mean, maybe working to, you know, protect some of his executive orders and things, I can't imagine him doing something that would be seen as seriously weakening the powers of the presidency as somebody new is coming in. I think it would just be too, too inflammatory. And I suspect that at this point, now that I wouldn't say this would be true in a year, but I think at this point, Congress might stand up and actually give President Trump those powers if the president tries to take them away. So I don't think that we're going to see a solution to that. You know, I think that at least in the short, long run, those extraordinary and troubling authorities are going to be there.
Yeah, I agree with you. But so and the problem for Obama is political. I mean, first of all, it's hypocritical for him to take them away when he wanted them for himself. So it would only be interpreted as not as a principled stance, but as a comment on his judgment about the incoming president.
Yes.
So there's,
and that's why I think Congress would, if those powers were taken away, I think, you know, in the first weeks of a new administration, Congress would give them back. Now in a year, I think there's a very good chance that the Republican Congress will be at odds with their guy over a number of things.
Right.
And one of them, you know, I mean, there's a streak of, concern for civil liberties on the Republican side that can be pretty strong if it's really challenged. So, you know, to express an opinion, I really do think that probably President Obama is doing the right thing in the way he's working with Trump. Apparently, Trump is talking to him a lot. Yeah. And I think I'm sure one of the things that the president-elect has encountered is the truth that a lot of things that were done over the last 8 years were not done simply because Obama was an out-of-control socialist. They were done because they constituted the best public policy you could make, given the circumstances, and that to just arbitrarily throw them out will have huge negative consequences, intended and unintended. And so, I think that as Obama works with Trump, it becomes more and more likely that some of these really key things, like Obamacare and the Iran deal, can be protected, and I think it's important.
Obamacare never struck me as any kind of radical socialist policy. It was, you know, cooked up by the Heritage Foundation, and before it was Obamacare, it was Romneycare. So I don't see why the Republicans, if they could rebrand it, wouldn't want to just hold on to it.
I think one of the things that happened during the Obama administration was that everything was painted rhetorically as being sort of Obama's radical left wing, his implementation of his agenda, and they've got to take some time to back down from that. I think the thing that was never explained properly, and I don't think President Obama has been that good an explainer in many ways, but you know, Obamacare is about the end of employer provided health insurance and the transition to something else, and this is a way of moving towards something else, and this is something we have to do, and it's not a destination, but it's on the way, and that's the way it always should have been explained, but I don't think I almost never heard that, but anyway, I think that as Obama engages Trump, particularly because Trump seems to be really susceptible to being talked into things by people, or he's influenced by people that he has conversations with more than books he reads or whatever. So, you know, I think that Obama's approach is exactly right. You know, just say, I want to help you. How can we, you know, how can I help you with this? And, so, you know, we will see. It's,
okay. So given that you think that Obama's doing the right thing there, my next question I can almost answer for myself, which is, what do you make of the campaign to convince electors to vote independently and against Trump?
Well, I was even not that happy about, you know, the protests in the communities around the country after T1 and so on.
So, some of my family has been participating in that. My teenagers were out in the streets after Trump was elected.
Yeah, I just think that, you know, you in a democracy, you kind of lose and you move on. I think there will be opportunities to maybe get back in the streets around, you know, I think when something specific starts to happen, then I think that's a time to try to protest. And then, of course, the key thing is to put pressure on the legislators, because there are lots of Republicans who have a real commitment because of their constituents to the social safety net or to the deal with Cuba, or, you know, they need to be worked on continuously, because we're going to depend on, you know, 50 moderate Republicans or reasonable Republicans in the House and, you know, 5 or 6 in the Senate to prevent bad things from happening and maybe make some good things happen. And then I think that's but to circle back to your original point, I mean, I think the effort to get the electors in the Electoral College to change, I just think that's not, I don't think it'll be effective, and I don't think it looks good. I mean, it's like, you know, my attitude is, you know, we lost. And the starting point, as I said earlier, our candidate and her message did not capture the imagination of a sufficient number of the American people in the right places. I mean, obviously, she's got a 2 million vote advantage in the popular vote and moving on, but that's just like, you know, we lost the game, and it turns out the referees, you know, didn't call a couple of plays right, and we lost. And, you know, what are you going to do?
I think the fact that those protests are happening that way indicates another kind of collapse in confidence in the government, in the, you know, in the Democratic Party and in the Congress, and in the police. And in all of it, because, you know, the people I know who were out in the streets, they were out in the streets because they saw people like Richard Spencer being attached to Trump, Trump going into the White House. And the fear was that this was no longer a civilized affair, that, you know, the people I know who were out in the streets were some of my gay friends. My daughter is gay and was out in the street for that. People who are very concerned about immigration and some, you know, Latino people. The black population in Portland is really small, but it wasn't that small out in the protests. And these are people who are basically, their feeling was they were sort of fighting for their life. It wasn't calculated, you know.
Well, I think that's right, but, you know, my feeling is always, you know, my hope is that everyone who was out in the street fought just as hard in the campaign to get Hillary elected. But my fear is that in some cases maybe they didn't.
Yeah, I don't think that they did. No, I don't.
Yeah,
think
and did. Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right, that generalized, justifiable suspicion of the authorities is a huge problem. I mean, I think one thing you and I didn't talk about is I think there's a tremendous failure of the press, and I can't even explain it exactly, but I think they were so flummoxed and so kept off guard by Trump early on, and their toolkit was so inadequate to deal with, you know, with persistent lying. They fell back on false equivalencies that they never should have allowed to, you know, to float. They talk about polls all the time, which is really nothing but speculating about the future. There's no meaning there, and now we know that followed all the way through to the day of the election, the polls were meaningless. And then you have two huge stories that are actually the kind of stories that I think Americans don't want to think about because they both go to the fundamental character of our system and the strength of our democracy was, you know, the Russian interference with the democratic process through WikiLeaks and Comey's interference with the election by, you know, just saying inappropriate things and then doing inappropriate things at inappropriate times. And I don't think we want to think about the FBI director trying to change an election. We certainly don't want to think about a foreign government for its own reasons coming in and trying to make things move in a certain way. And those stories just, to this day, have not really been brought forward. You know, we're still...
Well, the problem with the Russian story was it was coming... It came alongside a candidate that seemed to be willing to do things in Syria that might make build a conflict with Russia. That there was sort of the more Hillary Clinton spoke about Russian involvement or the Russian hackers, the more unsettled I became about the possibility of going to war with Russia. And maybe that was partly Russian propaganda. I mean, I know that it was because I saw an ambassador on Reuters, a Russian ambassador, say that if Hillary Clinton was elected, there would be a nuclear war, which was just this side of a threat, right?
And look, I mean, and Trump was giving signals that he might want to work with Russia in new ways in Syria. I think Hillary is certainly, you know, comes right out of the Madeleine Albright kind of, you know, school of, you know, using U.S. military to change things around the world. That really, you know, if you've got 12 or 13 agencies saying, you know, WikiLeaks doesn't have the ability to do its own research anymore, so somebody has to hand it stuff, and somebody handed that to them. And then somebody curated it, either before or after, because, you know, like maybe three of my emails were made public. There were probably three or four others that weren't made public, but I think it's because they didn't have any... They didn't have any potential to reflect badly on the campaign team. So, to me, that means not only were the emails hacked and turned over to someone, but somebody took the trouble to kind of sift through thousands and thousands and pull out the ones that seemed as though they might be troublesome
and create a narrative.
Create some kind of I think the and to me, you know, the press just. It was just not up to the, you know, just that constant, that, you know, that focus on, you know, on polls. And I almost think, to go back to this notion of identity politics, you know, the constant talk about polls and what white working class Americans said to a pollster. Mm-hmm. And then you'd get a reporter out in the field and they would walk up to someone and you almost had the impression that they were ready to say, well, now here I'm talking to a black person. Here, would you please say something African-American for me? I'm talking to a white worker outside a factory and he's not employed. Would you say something, you know, would you talk in the language of an unemployed white worker? And you started to get an almost formulaic, you know, relationship among polls, Trump's tweets, and then this kind of identity interviewing in which people are not allowed to be anything except what they appear to be demographically. And for the press to do a better job for us so that, because when we talk about not trusting the police or, you know, not trusting...
No one trusts
the voting
the media.
Process. A lot of it has to do with the way the media filters and interprets and explains or expands. And, you know, I mean, once these, and I forget who was the pioneer, it might have been, I think it was the ABC network, but I'm not certain. But once they put the news divisions under the entertainment division, we were heading toward different territory. And now we have, a kind of a TV celebrity who knows how to work with a entertainment-oriented news, media establishment, and how reporters can put the genie back in the bottle and turn into people who are trustworthy critics of government, who don't just feel that it's in their best interest to fan the flames of controversy, and to always have Chicago be the most dangerous place in the world, or to have Beirut. But, you name your city, and there are actually, for the most part, regular people leading regular lives. But all that comes at us is fear and danger and irresponsibility, and there was a big press failure on this, and what do we do about polls? I mean, they were wrong all the way.
Well, let me just say something about the FBI, Director Comey. When that happened, when he came forward again, right, what was it, 10 days before the election? What I wanted to find out was how much merit there was in reopening that investigation. And so I went online, I went to different television networks, I went to newspaper reports, and what I discovered was that all I could find were stenographers. I didn't have anybody doing any real investigative reporting or any objective or even quasi-objective analysis. So I could tell immediately when someone was a stenographer for the Clinton campaign, which I thought most of the television coverage, except for Fox, right? Most of the major newspapers were in the pocket of Clinton. Not cynically. I mean, there was a real good reason for people to be very upset, concerned about Trump. He was he's a threat, but they were abdicating their responsibility to be journalists and being stenographers often. And of course, that was confirmed that confirmation bias may have been set up because I did read the WikiLeaks and I saw some evidence of direct collusion between the campaign and journalists. So I wasn't sure what to make of that, of the FBI. And when I first heard that Comey was going to be, Comey had come forward and was reopening the investigation, I said, what is the Clinton campaign going to say now? Is he working for Russia too? At that point, the Clintons' defense had just run; it just had become threadbare, and part of it was that rather than explain a vision, they were simply trying to take out their opposition, just undermine their opposition. So, the last comment on this is just when they turn and instead of saying, "We wish Comey the best of luck. We know he's doing a hard job. We think the timing is suspicious, and we wish he had waited, but he didn't. We have nothing to hide, and we know the FBI is competent, and we wish that investigation the best of luck. We know what we've done, and we're ready to make sure Donald Trump doesn't become president." Instead of doing that, they spent like a week attacking Comey and just keeping the story in the news, and just keeping this back and forth on whether or not Clinton deserved to be in prison.
Well, I think that that's one of those situations where hindsight is 20/20, and we can now look at that and say, well, just to attack the opposition wasn't the right thing to do. And I understand that. I think if you were in the office trying to make a decision as to how you handle it, particularly with since Trump had established a lock her up theme for his campaign, and the first when Comey said, "Oh, the investigation continues," well, that just is fueling it. And I don't know how easy it is to get above that, to say, "Oh, we trust the FBI; they're going to do fine." Let's talk about the future of our society. Maybe you can do it, but maybe it's probably pretty tough. I think the stuff that I didn't look at a lot of the leaked emails and And I basically absorbed it through the ones that were quoted and reported. But to me, it looked just like regular campaign stuff, maybe actually on the mild side. Now, if we're going to have all of the emails of a campaign out, I mean, I think the Trump campaign should have been out there too. And who knows?
Trump, but see, the problem is you can't compare yourself to Trump, right? I mean, Trump was kind of openly and obviously manipulating the media, and the Fox News people were so clearly, Hannity was basically on his campaign staff, right? I mean, it turns out that he was like threatening some reporters for a good, to sic his Twitter following on them at the very least. This guy is basically a goon. He's, in my opinion, he's probably, I don't know. I won't say this, because he's going to be president. But I think he's a very, comparing yourself to him is a very low bar. The other thing is, obviously the media should report on everything that he did and absolutely go after him on all of the corruption that was around his campaign. But if it's normal for a journalist for The Hill, say, to turn in their opinion pieces to the Clinton campaign before they publish them, then something's very wrong.
Right. But I suspect that there were, maybe not so many, simply because the conventional media was so tilted toward Hillary, so even skeptical entities like the Wall Street Journal and Washington Post were kind of in her camp to some degree or another. But, I'm sure that below the level of Trump himself, that his campaign operatives were doing their best to find out what was going on and read things in advance and get, control the narrative, probably in a, in a smaller or more new media set of outlets. But, it's the same sort of thing. But I think the press, it's almost as though the profession of journalism, such as it is, needs to find a way to get back and rethink its values and the way those values are put into play. They reach the point where they can simultaneously report on something and act at the same time. They report that they shouldn't be reporting on it. They'll report it and then say, but we shouldn't really be validating this because it's not really true. I know I was listening to public radio, it might have been this morning, that Trump had, said this thing about he would have won the popular vote if there hadn't been, millions of people who unqualified or...
The illegals who voted, right?
Yeah, illegals, and they actually identified it as a lie.
Yeah.
But then I noticed that news report was run a couple hours later, and they changed it to something that, they softened that. But I think that's what has to start happening. And look, we're going to have to live through, at some point, maybe he won't. Maybe he will never do a press conference. There's nothing in, he doesn't have to. I can't imagine how it will work.
Mm-hmm.
So we may just see a totally different relationship between government and the press, in which they're frozen out and just get little tidbits on, tweets and, other social media. I don't know.
So if you were looking for Trump's weak point or a way to mitigate the Trump disaster, would you look to the Republican Party and the splits there as the best weakness to exploit, basically?
I do think that, if we just look at it historically, the losing an election like this will tend to drive Democrats together, and I think a lot of our internal differences will get papered over. So there will be a party on the Hill that will be quite united, particularly around things that that would be seen as really egregious rollbacks of government services and so on, or big treaties and that kind of thing. I think we'll have to depend on, the more moderate Republicans to stop some things and also call him on some things. I mean, he's going to be super vulnerable on conflict of interest. He'll ignore it, but it's at a certain point that could overwhelm him. And I think his personality, I mean, I hate to use the word temperament since it was used so much in the campaign, but his temperament, you know, is really something that that I think will be an ongoing problem. I mean, if we have a president who every time there's an attack in the press or something is trying to, you know, to doing a Twitter assassination attempt, I mean, it's just intolerable. And, you know, so those things. And then, of course, some of these characters, you know, and again, it's like these false equivalencies or normalizing things that are normal. I mean, yeah, it's nice to get Nikki Haley in there. I think she's a charming political figure. She's not qualified to be an ambassador to the UN. You know, neither Rudy Giuliani, you know, nor Mitt Romney is really qualified to be a Secretary of State. I prefer Romney, but it's not because he's a highly qualified internationalist. And so on down the line. I mean, what are these characters going to do when they actually have to start doing? And particularly since, unlike, you know, most other campaigns, you know, usually the campaign will come in with 15 or 20 people who have been inside for a while, who are experienced government professionals and can take over these jobs. And will Trump fire all the political appointees as soon as he becomes president? Because he can do that. He's got 2,000 jobs he can eliminate on the 21st of January. Bill Clinton did that when he came in the first time. And it created huge problems. And, of course, when George W. Bush came in, I was in government, and he didn't do that. I actually was in the Bush administration for a number of months. And but, you know, it's an attractive way to drain the swamp, you know. Hey, I'm firing all these people. So who knows?
Well, final question. Do you think that Sanders and Warren are going to be at the center of the Democratic Party now? And that the sort of more conservative wing, the Joe Lieberman side of the Democratic Party is on the way out, or is it going to be more balanced than that?
I hope so. I mean, I'm optimistic, but not necessarily encouraged. I mean, you know, Neera Tanden, who's a friend of mine, who's the head of the Center for American Progress, she did an interview with NPR, I guess, the weekend before last, and, you know, she was saying, well, our message on the economy just wasn't sharp enough for, you know, the working class, you know, men. And then, you know, I see Schumer, I think today or yesterday in the Times in an editorial, quoted the same way, our message needs to be sharper. And that's really not what we need. We need a different message that's, you know, that's inspiring and populist and for the people and engaging and all of these things. And what I hope is going away, and I think your question suggests this by in terms of who you put in what camp, I really think the administration I was in, Bill Clinton's administration, you know, made a pretty big accommodation with the world of big business. And so you stopped talking about unions, but you would talk about labor instead of unions. And you had a very, very kind of pro-business Democratic Party that just kind of looked the other way as a lot of things happened that really weren't in the interests of the common man. And if the Democrats, if my party is going to get itself back together and claim a bunch of seats in Congress, as it should in 2 years, we're going to have to do it on a different basis than triangulation and identity politics and, you know, trying to cobble together these coalitions around small issues. It's got to be, you know, a big vision. And I do think it's the more liberal or more left-leaning part of the party that's got to come forward and try to make that happen. But the old, but the old view is entrenched. You know, it's kind of institutionalized. So it'll be in Congress and in outside entities. So it'll be a lot of it'll be about pushing some old arguments and old people aside.
Yeah. Well, listen, thanks again for spending the time talking to me. I would love to have you back on again, maybe not so soon this time because I know you're busy. But before I get brought up on charges in front of the House of Un-American Activities Committee, which Newt Gingrich is going to restart, I'd like to have you back on the podcast.
Okay. Well, yeah. Well, if Newt if that pops up, then we'll talk again.
Yeah. If he does that, I'll be emailing you, and WikiLeaks will then be publishing it.
Yeah. There you go. That'll be fine. Okay. Right. Good talking to you.
Thank you.